Lucky by Dave Baldwin.
John and Elaine seemed like just an ordinary couple. A bit posh, but certainly not standoffish. We seemed to hit it off right from the start. It was 1977 when Janet and I first met them at a party given by Henry and Felicity, a couple we'd met on a cruise. The party was to celebrate Felicity's birthday. It could just as well have been the dog's birthday. The Chatterton Crambers would throw a party for any conceivable reason. Yeah, and what parties they were. An invitation to any one of their celebrations with a passport to an evening of the most fantastic food and wines in the company of interesting people, all bent on having a great time. Now, interesting for a wide variety of reasons. Yeah, we've met there with people from just about every walk of life, from royalty to infamy. I suppose that there's just one thing that they have in common. It's the pursuit of a fun time in the company of like-minded people. There's just one house rule at Henry and Fliss's parties. No photographs. Yeah, well, when we were first informed of this rule, we found it very strange, but with every party since, it's become clearer that some of the publicly famous guests are relaxing and enjoying their time out of the spotlight. Yes, John and Elaine seemed like just such a couple. Enormous fun to be with, but seeming to avoid public exposure. Elaine's principal passion is for horses, a passion she shared with John. She seemed to spend much of her free time grooming, training and competing with a horse she had recently purchased. Yes, sadly, neither Janet nor I have ever so much as sat on a horse, so our conversation on the subject was a bit one-sided. John, on the other hand, seemed totally at home with the subject. He seemed to be a man of many talents and interests. Yeah, a regular man for all seasons. One of John's passions was for fly fishing. At one of Henry's parties, he spoke of salmon fishing on Scottish rivers, and whilst I'd never had the funds required to pursue such an expensive pastime, I was a keen trout fisherman and enjoyed casting flies on many of the small rivers and chalk streams in the southwest of England. John was immediately taken with the idea of a day's trout fishing together. He had spent some time on the River Test as a guest of a friend. Again, he'd experienced the most expensive venue. Yeah, this man clearly had wealthy friends. Yeah, well, as a friend of mine, he'd have to settle for a day on the Kennet, a fine river, but lacking the pedigree of England's finest chalk stream, the Test. So, one Monday morning in early summer, we met in the parking place adjacent to a particular pub on the bank of the River Kennet at Hungerford. John had said that all of his equipment was in a lodge in Scotland, so I brought along a spare rod, reel, line, net, flies and so forth. We walked down to the bank of the river and assembled our kit. It was a beautiful early summer morning and the sunlight sparkled on the water surface. As we started to fish, I could see that he was an experienced angler. The way in which he handled and assembled the equipment, his approach to the water, all spoke of experience and skill. He seemed totally at home in this environment and this situation, and that was really the story of the day. On the couple of occasions we'd met in the past, John seemed friendly, but somehow slightly uncomfortable, always seeming to preserve some space between himself and others. But as the morning wore on, he became more and more relaxed, as he was clearly enjoying a much-loved pastime in a familiar environment. During the course of the morning, we covered 700 or 800 yards of the bankside and took a dozen or so fine brown trout between us. We then took a short break and strolled back to the pub for a sandwich and a pint. In that short break in the pub, I discovered more about this man than in three or four evenings at Henry's parties. I think that he felt totally at home by the riverside and felt no need to adopt any persona beyond that of a friend in mutual enjoyment of an outdoor pursuit. Indeed, he did remark that too much of his life had been spent in tension-building, smoke-filled rooms, and the more days such as this would have changed the course of his life. Even though this was a pretty bold statement, I didn't pursue it. I had the feeling that he would tell me only what he wanted me to know, and when he wanted me to know it, and that any further questioning would be an unwelcome intrusion. John spoke of his fly fishing for peacock bass and the Amazon River in Brazil. Great sport, he said, for giant fish, but not a patch on the pursuit of brown trout in our native chalk streams. It seems that he spent the last couple of years in South America before coming back to the homeland 6 months ago. It was late June when John phoned and asked whether Janet and I might be interested in a day at Bedford Hall in Berkshire, where Elaine would be competing in an eventing competition. Well, that sounded really very grand, don't you know? But our social secretary confirmed that there was little else in our diary for that day, so we accepted the invitation. On the day, Elaine drove down to Swallowfield early with her horse, and Janet and I picked up John mid-morning. It was a beautiful day, and the occasion had attracted big crowds. I hadn't realised what a complex business eventing is. The day was broken into three parts, so the crowd gathered in different areas of the venue as the event progressed. Janet and I were complete beginners amongst a crowd of spectators who sounded like experts. We stood at the side of an arena-like area bounded by straw bales as fine-looking horses and riders went through complex exercises in horsemanship. This was the horsey set. The horsey set at play where lady spectators wore headscarves and the men wore three-piece tweed suits and called each other Rupert and Henry. All of the horsemen and women looked the same, seated upright in their black velvet jackets, white jodhpurs and black peaked hard hats. It was only because the announcer said that this was Elaine Carter on Liberty that I recognised our friend. To my untrained eye, she performed faultlessly with her beautiful chestnut mare, but whilst John was delighted with her performance, he indicated those elements where faults had occurred. He clearly was an expert horseman. He was also not married to Elaine, since we were originally introduced to him as John Williamson, not Carter. Another piece of this mystery man's background was emerging. Elaine performed similarly in the jumping section of the competition, which placed her in a strong position entering the final discipline, the cross-country. For this event, we went out to an adjacent field where one of the course's most challenging obstacles had been erected. This was a high hedge, behind which was a 6 feet stretch of water. The horses would have to jump this with enough forward speed to clear the water. Daunting prospect, but negotiated with ease by most of the competitors. This was just one of the many obstacles in a course of about 3 miles through fields and woods. Like so many others, we chose to watch at this most challenging point of the event to see competitors arriving at 5 or 6 minute intervals. Elaine arrived at this jump towards the end of the field and, to John's delight and relief, cleared it perfectly. It was an hour later that the faults at each discipline had been registered and totaled to provide overall competition results. Yet apparently eventing competitors are graded according to the experience and qualification, and this particular competition was open to those who had achieved an intermediate novice level of competence. So Elaine was competing against her peers and came a highly creditable third place. A great day and totally new experience for Janet and myself. It was on the way back in the car that Janet asked John how long he and Elaine had been together. His answer was surprising. Though I've known her as the boss's daughter for nearly 2 years, but we've only been together for 6 months. I hope we'll always be together. We took John back to his home, which was a small rented cottage in a field on the outskirts of a Gloucestershire village. We went in and John made us a cup of tea whilst we waited for Elaine to turn up with the horse box. We chatted for a while, mostly about South American politics. Then when Elaine arrived, we helped to unhitch the box and let Liberty out to graze the field. On our way back home, Janet and I were discussing just what we knew about this strange couple. So, John's boss is an Englishman who settled in Brazil many years ago and became the head of a merchant bank in Rio. So, this couple are not married and returning from South America, where John was working for her father's merchant banking business. Well, that probably poses more questions than it answers. But the picture of John Williamson is gradually emerging. This slow drip of information has informed us that this man is an unmarried merchant banker who spent the last 2 years in Brazil. He has a love of fly fishing, a knowledge of horses, and resents having spent so much of his time in smoke-filled rooms. This, of course, is pretty unremarkable and really doesn't matter anyway. I mean, John is a nice guy who is splendid company. It really only matters because the man has an air of mystery about him, which I find quite challenging. It was late on a Wednesday evening in August that Henry phoned me. Had I seen John? Well, no, not since the party on Saturday. Why do you ask? He said that he'd had a call from the police. Someone who had attended the party on Saturday had recognised John as someone wanted for murder. The police wanted to know everything that Henry knew about John and Elaine, including where they lived. The police went immediately to their address to find it locked and deserted. Their car was traced to a hire company, who stated that the car had been returned on Monday. The couple had disappeared without trace. It seems that the man who claims to have recognised John was a regular gambler at Aspinall's Casino in the early 70s, and it's there that he saw John. He describes him as having black hair and a black moustache in those days, but is convinced that this is the same man. If he's right, then this really is an important moment in criminal history. Police forces internationally have been trying to trace this man since his disappearance from his London house one night in November 1974. I am, of course, speaking of Lord Lucan, Lucky Lucan to his friends. Richard John Bingham, 7th Earl of Lucan. Educated at Eton, served for 2 years in the Coldstream Guards, resigned as a merchant banker to become a professional gambler, where he spent most evenings in smoky, alcohol-fueled gaming rooms. Separated from his wife and children, then, on that infamous night in 1974, he went back to his house in Belgravia and, mistaking the nanny, Sandra Ribbit, for his wife, bludgeoned her to death. Then, when he was interrupted by his wife, he attempted to kill her before fleeing the scene and has never been seen since. His car was found abandoned at New Haven with the blood-stained lead pipe in the boot. Since then, there have been more than 200 reported sightings of him throughout the world. None have been substantiated. Was that man who sat with me and talked of his love of fly fishing really a callous murderer? Would the love for a partner shine as brightly in the eyes of a killer?
Lucky was written, read, and produced by Dave Baldwin. The incidental music, Hip Jazz, is from bensound.com.